Hello there, this is Fiona, host and main GM for What Am I Rolling, a twice monthly RPG one-shot podcast. This is a bonus Q&A episode to tide us over to the next one-shot, and it is indeed a very special Q&A, as this week I had the absolute pleasure of interviewing Chris Bassetti, award-winning game designer, writer, and musician. Chris has written for games like Pathfinder 2, Fallout, Hunter the Reckoning, and Cyborg. They are best known for their indie breakout solo journaling game, The Wretched, which was selected as one of Tabletop Gaming Magazine's best games of 2020, and has since spawned hundreds of new games based on its Wretched and Alone engine. It was wonderful to talk to Chris about their passion for creating narrative gameplay and storytelling. I really enjoyed playing The Wretched on this very podcast a couple of years ago, so I highly recommend checking out their website, Loot the Room, to see the full range of games and supplements. Also, their soundtracks for The Wretched and for Orbital Blues are absolutely cracking and can be found on your streaming platform of choice. I'll put a link to Chris's work and their newsletter on the What Am I Rolling website and in this episode's show notes. Let's just get straight into it. Could you introduce yourself for us? Who are you and what do you do, my friend?
Yeah, my name is Chris Bassett. I am a game designer from Manchester. Among other things, I'm a musician and a writer and an illustrator as well. I'm probably best known for my solo journaling game, The Wretched, but I also write adventures for games like Morkborg, my own game, a dungeon game, and I freelance for things like Fallout, Pathfinder 2, other things I'm not going to list because I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about
them.
There
you go. Not, see, there's always, you're always like, wait a minute.
Yeah, et cetera. I'm a miscellaneous person.
Oh, put that on your business card. So Chris, how did you get into RPGs? Like, what was your sort of origin story?
It's a very traditional one. My dad used to play D&D a lot, and I used to go and watch him and his friends play it in like the early 90s, and I didn't understand what the hell was going on. I remember his friend had this big, like a dungeon out of terrain and stuff, and I was just amazed by this diorama that they were playing with. And then in 1994, for my birthday, TSR released like the revised second edition of D&D, of AD&D, and my dad bought me the First Quest starter set, which was sort of like aimed at kids. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've been playing games since then. As a late teenager and early 20s, I used to make shitty little zines and like take them to Dragon Meet and try and sell them to people and stuff, but nobody was interested, and I was on forums and stuff. But then it was in 2016 I started like blogging in earnest and started writing, actually, you know, making actual products and trying to get people to pay for them with varying levels of success. And I've just sort of built from there, really. I've been doing it full-time for 3 years as of this year, so it's going okay.
What got you into then writing stuff then? Like, sounds like it was fantasy mostly, but I know you've spread out into, you know, different genres of sort of sci-fi and horror and obviously different systems, as you said. But what was sort of the push to like, actually, I want to write stuff rather than just play in it or just run it?
I don't know, really. I've always been a writer. Like, since I was a kid, I've always... It's a classic story. A lot of RPG designers are failed novelists, and I'm very much a failed novelist. I spent years and years and years like trying to break into short fiction, and like I did my master's is in creative writing, so I've always been a writer. And it was just, weirdly, it was actually Critical Role that got me back into RPGs in a big way back in whatever year it was. I think 2016. I started watching it like from, I think, the second live show, and I was like, I really miss D&D. And then I found out about the DMs Guild through that, and I was like, sure, I could put some stuff up on the DMs Guild. And then I realized that it was actually really fun, and that I was already kind of having more success at RPGs than I'd ever had at fiction. So I just was like, let's do this for a bit and see how it goes. And ironically, I'm now in a state where I'm like, I really want to get back to writing fiction.
Like a never-ending cycle.
Yeah.
But at least this time it's like, is, you know, successful any nominated RPG designer going into novel. So you're not going from that failed novelist to the stage again. So do you have a particular like favorite genre you like writing for, or is it more about the system, that what interests you at the time? Like you were saying, you've got an incredible sort of portfolio of work. Is it just like, oh, I want to work on this currently, or like you're inspired by someone else's like game? When you sit down and go, okay, next project, what is it that sort of comes to mind first?
Oh God, next project is, oh, I've got, my ADHD is like so bad. So next project is always a case of what is interesting to me this week.
Yeah.
I've always been drawn to horror more than anything. Horror for me is not a genre. It's a thing that you sort of like drape over other genres.
Yeah.
You can write horror anywhere. And obviously it lends itself to like sci-fi horror and fantasy horror, and especially within tabletop role-playing, like they're the two big genres. But like, you know, what does romance horror look like? I want to write some romance horror now that I've said that.
Heck yeah. That's your next project. Yeah. You got it.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm drawn to horror, and just because my start in the hobby was in D&D, which is sort of classic, you know, kitchen sink fantasy. And that's always going to be my comfort zone.
Sounds like it's more that you're inspired by, interested you this week rather than like, oh, this is an interesting setting or an interesting mechanic. Can I do anything with it?
Yeah, I'm definitely less interested in system or less inspired by system. Like, I much prefer system to sort of get out of the way when I'm playing games. In the past, I've tended towards system agnostic, which largely means play this with some form of D&D, let's be honest. I'm more interested in, you know, weird little people in weird little places doing weird little things, and the actual mechanisms of what that means in a game sort of take a back seat. Which isn't to say I don't enjoy system building. Like, I just did some, I say just, maybe a year ago, I wrote some monsters for, you know, MCDM Arcadia, which is no longer around, unfortunately, but I wrote some monsters for that. And like building monsters in games like 5th edition or like Pathfinder or Dungeon Crawl Classics, where there's a lot of moving parts and like system is very present, I find building monsters really fun in a way that I don't really find fun in a lighter system, because there it's just sort of like ideas based, like you're just given an idea of what the monster is and the stats don't really matter. So I enjoy digging into the mechanical side of things when I'm making monsters and things, but when I'm making adventures, settings, fiction, if you like, much less concerned with system.
I think that's it. And just to go back to your comment about like horror as a veil, as someone who runs a lot of horror games as well, it's interesting because in this time and age of obviously like lines and veils, safety tools, incredibly important. I find it really interesting that sometimes when we're talking to people about horror, they go, oh, I can't play horror games, or I can't play horror video games to play. And obviously, I don't wish to, you know, say, oh, that's silly. Because obviously, you know, there are certain topics that they can't cover. But I always think that there is a horror story for everyone. Yeah. And it's all about the degrees of stuff. So I absolutely feel you on that. Like, you know, like horror, it is a veil over this, you know, sci-fi, it is, you know, even historical, all that sort of thing. And I just think you can really delve in deep. It's just a way to explore things that you maybe sit out just outside of our comfort zone and just be able to push that barrier a little bit. And I just, I'm always a big fan of, like, I think, like, I'm always like, everyone should run an RPG. Everyone should, you know, play in an RPG. But I'm always like, everyone should have a go at playing in a horror RPG of some sort. So I'm getting more and more niche.
Yeah. My most well-known game is ostensibly a horror game, and I think my most controversial opinion is that you can't mechanize horror. Like, there's no such thing as a scary system. Like, Jenga inherently is not scary, or it wouldn't be a party game for kids. You know, it's when it's the fiction that you attach to it that makes it a horror game, which is why it really bugs me sometimes when people talk about like writing horror. I'm doing finger quotes for people who can't see me, but people talk about writing horror games and their focus is on like what do the mechanisms of the game do, rather than what tools are you giving to build horror fiction, which I think is the important part of a horror game.
And I think, just to go on to The Wretched then briefly as well, because that is also unique in the sense of, yes, it is a sci-fi horror, it's more unique because it's like a solo one. And I think a lot of solo RPGs, they tend to be sort of very, very reflective, which is what The Wretched is to an extent. But what I quite like about it when I played it is that it fits in so well, this idea, obviously, you're alone on a ship and there's another creature that's hunting you and stuff like that. But it's not just about that end game of like, you're not going to escape. Let's face it, the odds are incredibly against you. You're sitting in this huge empty ship where everyone else has died and reflecting upon those things. And I just think that, again, it's not for everyone, I understand that, but there's something about solo RPGs, which people, I think, are getting more and more into. They're becoming more and more popular.
Definitely, yeah.
I think there's something magical about it compared to group play. It's that own sort of, like, we were talking about it before, just that lines of bells, sort of like, you know, make sure that you're willing to just to, what is your comfort zone and stepping outside it and just thinking about it for yourself, because we don't get chance to do that really in our busy lives just now, just to sit and take time to do it.
I think that's a real strength of solo games. I think of it often in terms of the difference between like a novel and a film or a play, a stage play, where when you watch a film or a play, it's mostly concerned with the exterior of the characters. It's hard to get in the head of characters when you're observing. And a lot of play, this is obviously not always the case, but a lot of group RPG play is a lot more observational. It's more about the action and the surface level things, because you can only ever really know what's going on inside your own head. You can't ever inhabit someone else's head, no matter what they're telling you. And I think solo games have a really unique opportunity to tap into the interiority of a character in the same way that a novel would. And so I think the best solo games, and you know, they're often called journaling games, which sort of implies that you're journaling, and journaling tends to be a very personal, introspective process. And I think the best solo games tap into that in a way that group games are not unable to, but less able to or less inclined to.
Less inclined to, for sure. Yeah, it's again, there's something more being secure with yourself, be to be able to write down certain things or say certain things without necessarily the judgment of others. Like, I can think of some other sort of RPGs, like The Beast is the one I always remember, where it's like, you know, 21 days and you do that prompting stuff, and then at the end the choice of like, do you stay with the beast or do you kill them, all that sort of thing. When I played it for What Am I Rolling, like, I put it on and that for me was a thing, but talking to the designer about it, she was like, oh, the whole point is that you burn the diary, you know, but never speak to anyone. You've hacked the rules by putting it out there. And that's I mean, of course, because that was a very particular type of genre. But what I appreciate in sort of RPGs now, and certainly I know you put it in The Wretched, and I know there's other games about it, is that the idea is that, yeah, you can write it down and keep it in the diary, or you can make it as like audio logs, or you can do it as Twitter posts and stuff like that. And just really exploring that medium of just trying to create a story. It doesn't have to be for anyone else to see, but I just think there's something cool about being able to do that and create something like that. Like, I know there's like Don't Play This Game, my Parabol games just now, which is like being haunted by an entity, and that, you know, you could journal it, or you could go out to places safely, of course, take photos, all that sort of thing, and create almost like an artifact. And these artifact RPGs just now, I think they're so different and unique, and certainly during the time of the pandemic, I think very valuable, just as a way to just keep that creativity going up and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when you play in a group, the artifact of play is often the stories that you tell each other afterwards.
Yes.
And when you play on your own, you again have less access to that sort of thing. So I think it's really fun to have like a thing that you have made at the end of the game.
You're a musician as well, and you've done soundtracks for not only your own games but other games as well. Again, another thing I think in recent years where, you know, people are like, hey, do you want a soundtrack for your game? And I think what that to me is obviously incredibly special as well, just because I use a lot of music in my games, for my home games, and it just really heightens, obviously, the group play and listening and stuff. So my question to you for this then is sort of like, when you know you're going to design a soundtrack for either one of your games or another game, what goes through your head in terms of that process? Do you think, okay, it needs to be in a certain number of tracks, or do you just go and just design or compose as much as you want and then sort of break it down? Like, where do you start with something that I will say this as someone who is a non-musician, you know, I don't necessarily know where you'd go with that process. I presume you get a brief of some sort.
Yeah. Like, so I just did the soundtrack for the new Orbital Blues book.
Yes.
Orbital Blues Afterburn. And I did the soundtrack for the original Orbital Blues. And the brief for the original Orbital Blues was Beach Boys, but sad and in space. Which didn't end up as, because I started writing it and I was like, I'm not really capable of writing Beach Boys music because I'm British. My idea of Americana is very different to, you know, Brian Wilson's. But then that sort of worked for Orbital Blues anyway, because Orbital Blues is a game that's very interested in Americana and like retro-futuristic Americana, but written by British people. And so as I was trying to write this Beach Boys-esque music, it started sounding more like The Shadows and Hank Williams. And then from there, weirdly, that style of guitar sort of like segues into like early Arctic Monkeys sort of style. So the brief for Orbital Blues was that I was inhabiting a fictional band within the universe. So the process for writing that soundtrack was, you know, what does a band in this universe sound like? And then the second album was like, what does their difficult second album where they're trying a different genre sound like?
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really fun. But was a very different process to something like my own soundtrack for The Wretched. So it was in the middle of lockdown. I was still having to go into the office in lockdown, but I was like on my own at my desk. And all I was doing was watching films all day while working. And I went on a big John Carpenter binge. And my pitch for The Wretched was, I want to write a game that feels to play the same way it feels to listen to a John Carpenter soundtrack, if that makes any sense. When I decided I wanted to write music for it, because the game was inspired by like John Carpenter films and is very obviously heavily inspired by Alien as well, writing a soundtrack for it was sort of like me saying to myself, how would you score a film of this game? And so I approached it much more like what I did for that was I played through the game myself and made audio logs for it and then sort of sequenced them in the order of a narrative and then scored that narrative and then took the logs out again. So what you're hearing in the soundtrack for The Wretched is the score to the game of The Wretched that I played that nobody's ever heard.
That's amazing. But that's such, yeah, that totally makes sense of just like, as you said, like trying to score a film. Normally they have the film. And so they're like, okay, they can watch it through. And now you're like, well, I've got my game. I never knew that. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was really fun. Somebody pay me to score a film, please, because it's what I really want to do at the moment.
What do you find is like the most challenging thing to do when you are putting together an adventure or a scenario? Like, what is it, sort of the obstacles that you're aware of that you have to come across that you find particularly challenging?
The hardest thing for me personally is always managing my ADHD with it. So starting a project is always the easiest part because there are 1,000 projects that I could sort of like lay hands on and start today and get to a certain point. But there are two things that happen. The first is that the more I work on it, the more excited I get, and the more I'm like, oh, I could do this and this and this, and scope creep happens. And so reining myself in on things is always tough. And sort of part of that is finishing things, because what always inevitably happens is that it goes from that initial excited brain has grabbed onto it and wants to do this thing to that excitement's worn off and now it feels like work, which is great because I love my work, but the brain wants to always be excited by things. And so sometimes you get to a point it's like, oh shit, this is really hard now. And when you add that onto the scope creep that happened earlier on, you sit there and look at it and think, god, this is massive and I don't know how I'm gonna finish this. That's definitely the hardest point, and I've got better at managing it over the years, especially as it's become my full-time job and I've have more experience of seeing projects through to the end. But there are definitely like two projects that are well overdue at this point in time that I'm desperately trying to finish up.
The flip side of that question then is that, what is the thing that sparks you joy when you're on a project like that? Like, what is it that you're like, oh, I can't wait to get to this? Or like, you always, you know that when you get to that particular element, you're always going to enjoy it.
I really love the writing process specifically. A lot of writers will tell you how much they hate the act of writing. It's such a cliche for people to say, oh, writing's hard and I hate it. I love it. It's great. It's amazing. You get these moments where you're writing something and you realize that it's linking back to something you've already written in a way that you didn't plan, or where you write something and it sparks another 5 ideas and you're like, oh shit, and the project just sort of like takes shape in front of you almost itself. A lot of the time writing doesn't feel like active work, it feels like just transcribing something that already exists, and that's magic, and it's one of my favorite things in the world. Because I didn't have much money at the start of my career, I've had to learn to do like layout and art and marketing and etc., all the things that aren't writing that you need in order to be able to release written work. I've had to learn to do that myself, and I'm glad that I can do that. I'm glad that I have that skill set, because it means I don't have to rely on anyone other than me. But at the same time, if I could hand all that off to somebody and just sit and write the words, I'd be happy as a pig in shit.
It's so true though, because I think people don't realize that, and it goes through a lot of like sort of areas of expertise and stuff, like content creators in general. It's not just about the final product. You have to be your own social media manager, you have to be your own hype person, you have to be your own playtester, and all, and it just gets to a point where you have all these roles, and ultimately if you were like a proper company or whatever, you'd be paying these people to do it. It's kind of interesting that we as society, and maybe this is just some old thinking from a couple of years ago, like when people used to be like, oh, you're this, oh, well, that doesn't seem like a lot. And you're like, actually, you have to be not only do all these roles, but you have to constantly be like, come on, we've got this. You have to really like give that energy to yourself, because, you know, I can imagine like some days it's just like a slog. You yeah. don't want to do it. And there's no real like sort of sick days in the sense of like, that project's still going to be there tomorrow. You can't yeah. just like have a team meeting with yourselves and be like, right, we're going to get this done.
I'm on the tail end of an illness that has sort of lingered for about 2 months at this point. Mm-hmm. It basically stole all of February from me.
Mm.
So I had a few projects where I started the year and I was like, these things are going to be done by the end of February. And we're now a week into March and I've not touched them because I've been sick. And it's like, that shit needs to get done. I'm the only person who can do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not easy, obviously, like, you know, also I don't have to work for somebody else, so
yeah.
I'm very lucky in that regard, but it's work. People think, oh, you sit at home and you play games all day.
You gotta talk to your boss about your own raises. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly.
Let's talk about a dungeon game, because obviously we've spoken about The Wretched, and we've spoken about a couple of the other things. Like you said, you've done some supplements for like Troika and stuff like that. To those people who don't know, what is a dungeon game and how does it differ from other games that are already out there?
Oh, God, that's a good question. So a dungeon game is ostensibly a rules-light OSR-style dungeon crawler game. You know, so if you're familiar with games like Mugborg or Kern or insert any other three-stat dungeon crawler game yeah. here, you're on the right page. I think some of the things it does differently are it's not actually as rules-light as it pretends to be.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's always interested me in games, you know, we have all these stats to represent like strength, dexterity, intelligence, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I go to the gym and I like lifting really heavy things. And the genesis of a dungeon game was when I was in between really heavy sets in the gym at about 5 a.m, thinking about how strength isn't a constant. You can lift a weight one day that you can't lift the next day or even 5 minutes later because you've exhausted yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I started thinking about how to model that in games.
Mm.
And I came up with this system whereby when you attempt something and you fail the roll, you can exert yourself. So you can turn the roll into a success, but it makes your stat lower until you get a chance to rest. So you can do the thing now, but then it becomes harder to do anything else in future. And that sort of formed the core of the system. And I realized that I could combine that with, there's a lot of talk in sort of like dungeon-based fantasy and like, you know, violent fantasy games, because that's what they are, about decoupling advancement and experience from the violence. So, you know, traditionally you go into a dungeon, you kill monsters, you get experience and you get better at killing monsters. And so I sort of wanted to decouple that and say, well, what if you could get better at doing the things that you do because you're doing them, not because you have killed something? Like, it doesn't make any sense for you to get better at climbing a wall because you murdered 7 people on Tuesday.
You absorb their energy and then you're like, right.
Yeah, exactly. And so I built this whole exertion system into the advancement system of the game. There are like 3 different advancement tracks in the game, if you like. There's the exertion system where your stats get better the more you use them.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you push yourself outside your comfort zone using them. There is traditional experience for gathering treasure and doing violent things, which just sort of makes you get better at recovering from your excursions.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a system called scars, where anytime you die violently, anytime you reach 0 hit points, if you don't die, you make like a death saving throw, like in 5th edition or whatever, you gain a new scar.
Mm-hmm.
And the scars make you better at doing violence, but also make it more likely that you're going to die violently, because each time you reach 0 hit points, you make a death check that's informed by how many scars you have. So,
oh, interesting.
If you continue to kill things and get in fights and get the shit kicked out of you, your chances of surviving that, there's almost a curve on it. There's a point where you get better and better at being horribly violent towards people, and then it very quickly tails off into a little death spiral.
Ooh.
Personally, I think it's a really neat little system. I've been running it a lot over the past 18 months, two years, and having a great time with it. And I think one thing that separates it from a lot of other games in its milieu, if you like, is that it's very much a living game. I'm playing it a lot, I'm running it a lot of people, and it's very much evolved through play from that initial idea, rather than just being like, I want to write my own version of D&D.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, there was definitely an element of I want to write my own version of D&D in it, but it's very much a reflection of the game that I run personally. Yeah. And I think it's really great, honestly. Obviously, I would say that because I wrote it.
It's so true, though, what you said about that exertion stuff, because that instantly makes me think of, and do correct me if it's not like this at all, it makes me think of, you know, that whole thing of like the energy levels in general, so that, you know, if you've got an ongoing health condition or anything like that, and just the fact that, like, okay, you know, the spoons theory, that idea of like, I've only got several spoons today. And so that's what it makes me think of instantly, as sort of a way that I can categorize it. And like you said, like lifting between sets. So it makes me think instantly that everyone can relate to this, going, yeah, I can't keep kicking down the doors, no matter what my big fighter keeps saying. So I'll just kick down the door. I'm like, God, you're going to fuck your knees if you keep doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I never thought about it in those terms, actually, but I am, you know, I've got a few chronic illnesses that impact me on a day-to-day basis. And I think there is some of that in there.
Yeah.
One of the things with the exertion thing is that you don't always know how much you're going to recover in between adventures as well.
Right. It's not a guaranteed automatic everything comes back.
Yeah, it's not a guaranteed automatic everything comes back, and it's not a guaranteed automatic it's all come back and now you're better at this thing as well.
Mm.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that in terms of like spoons theory and illness, but I think maybe subconsciously some of that has seeped in.
The other weird thing that's coming to my mind, I'm sure you've seen, there's that dog on TikTok was like, is it a bones day or a non-bones day? You know, that's the thing.
Bones and no bones.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, can you just imagine you do it with skeletons? Oh, no bones. But it's, it's so interesting because we do assume, because like, I play and run D&D quite a lot myself as a sort of a home game. And what I do find interesting is that when you introduce, oh, we could play this other game, or that people are going to want to create certain things that aren't already in D&D, but they're, oh, we'll just use the rule set anyway as a way, because we don't want people to worry about like learning a new system. But like something like this, just the concept of like exertion and that idea, like, yeah, the more you fuck around, the more you're going to find out.
Yeah. Recently, I've been rereading all of Joe Abercrombie's novels, like the First Law trilogy and the three that came after it, because I haven't read his newer ones and I wanted to read them, but I wanted to catch up first. Whether I knew it or not, I think a dungeon game is in conversation with a lot of the ideas that have come out of grimdark fantasy as well, because grimdark is obviously a reaction to that idea of heroic fantasy where everyone is, you know, they're a superhero and you can kill 10,000 orcs and then go out and be fine the next day.
Mm.
And, you know, you read Abercrombie's books and, you know, they're full of people who are seriously damaged from the violent and horrible lives that they've led, who are continuing to try and lead violent, horrible lives and finding it harder and harder to keep up, or they're trying to be better and finding themselves trapped in a spiral of violence. And I think, especially with the scars system, in a dungeon game, I think that's the sort of thing I was trying to tap into.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, it's that old cliche, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Like, if you make a living kicking down the doors of people's houses and stabbing them and taking their things, eventually someone bigger than you is going to stab you back and
it's going to do the same thing to you. Yeah, you've chosen this path. Yeah, consequences on the horizon, as it were.
Yeah. What I will say about Scar, like, obviously, I want people to check out a dungeon game and it's free, so there's no reason not to check it out. For the Scars especially, I will say massive content warning for some really seriously upsetting body horror, which I've spent my life doing very stupid things, either, you know, playing rugby or climbing things I shouldn't climb, or, you know, I used to be the front man in a band and I used to jump off speaker stacks onto concrete floors, and alongside, you know, having like problems with my teeth, chronic pain issues, etc. So I have a very deep understanding of, and I think appreciation for, a little bit of a masochistic appreciation for, the ways that bodies can break and hurt. And I put a lot of that into the game. So if you're squeamish, maybe write some of your own scars instead of using the ones that I wrote.
Well, no, it's true. And like stuff like the Alien RPG and all that stuff, they have their critical injuries table. And obviously the further you go down, the more you're like, oh dear.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's about sort of coming from that sort of lived experience to an extent, but also like, appreciating it to an extent and being able to be like, this is happening in the game, but we don't need to describe it in so much detail. It is like, we can push the things on that, but it's good to know about that compliment. And I agree as well. It's just like, that doesn't suit for what we want just now. What do you think it is? And you could always do the sort of, the gauntlet sort of thing. Oh, it's much worse than that, but you don't need to go into too much detail, which I quite like. It's like, oh, you think it's just death? It's worse than that, you know, that sort of
Yeah, absolutely. Someone said on Twitter the other day that the best and the most effective kind of lasting injury tables are largely just concerned with sort of stating quite flatly what has happened rather than trying to romanticize them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a really good observation, because there's no there's no poetry, I don't think, to the scars that I wrote. They're very matter of fact about this is what's happened to you and this is what it looks like. And they're left to you to interpret what that means for your character.
Yeah,
I think that's quite important.
I work with academics who are in the healthcare profession, and my own family, we've got various doctors and stuff in there. And it is putting it into terms when you're describing something to someone in the most matter of fact ways of doing it. And if you're listening, you're like, oh my God, that is actually a really horrible thing that's happened. But they just carry on sort of very matter of factly, very neutral about it, so that they get the importance of it across rather than going, or really indulge detail. So that's how I relate to it in that sort of sense. It's like, okay, so this has happened, this, and just keeping it as neutral as possible.
Yeah.
And then it's up to the individual to interpret how that is. And it's just to get that information across so that they can understand it as well. So that's what I see in like you said, crushed head. That sort of thing. It's just like very straightforward. Your head has been crushed.
There's a fine line between body horror and fetishizing injury.
100%. If someone was getting into designing their own games and thinking about, becoming a game designer, or even just writing their own sort of stuff, do you have any sort of big bits of advice that you would suggest? I appreciate, this one tip, etc., might not be the thing for it. And because you've got obviously a wealth of experience, and obviously you've done such an incredible amount of, not only writing new music, all that sort of thing, writing for different games. But I guess for you, if someone came to you and was like, I'm thinking about getting into game design, what would be your sort of main bit of advice?
Do lots of small things and fail very quickly, I think, is the advice for getting into anything, really. The more variety of things you try your hand at, the more you're going to figure out what you like.
Mm-hmm.
I was scared of writing adventures for ages because they seemed daunting. And then when I finally did it, I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. This is the shit I really enjoy. And yet fail quickly, fail often, and learn from your failures and move on. The thing that I've tried to do ever since I started taking game design seriously and wanting to make a career out of it, is that I've always tried to learn one new thing from every project. And I think that's the main advice I'd give people. Whether it's actively trying to learn one new thing, so it's like, okay, I'm making this project, I can't afford to pay someone to do layout, I'm going to teach myself how to make a book cover, or I'm going to teach myself how to lay out a book in InDesign, for example, or whether it's not going into a project intending to learn something, but looking at it after the fact and being like, okay, this could have been better. How could it have been better? What can I do differently next time? It's very easy to just sort of almost passively just put things out.
Yes.
I think the people who make a career out of it and the people whose work improves regularly, and I do include myself in that, as egotistical as it sounds, because I think my work does improve on itself, because I try to make it improve on itself. And I think part of that is actively looking at your old work and being like, what should I have done differently? And what worked? What did you do well here that you can replicate?
Absolutely.
Or what did you wish you'd known going into this that you can take into the next thing? I think just being actively critical and reflective of your own work puts you ahead of a lot of people.
100%.
That'll be an unpopular opinion. But
no, I don't think so at all. You'd be surprised how much work I send back to academics saying, I need you to do this. And they go, wait, what? The only thing I'd add on to that is that, leaving yourself time to do that revision stuff.
Mm.
The idea of failing often and be willing to fail is something that I think is just a life lesson for general. I'm an improviser as well. And obviously the whole point is make mistakes, all that sort of thing. But I think people don't realize how great is to make mistakes, because it's not about humiliating yourself. It's about you need to make a mistake to learn. As much as we all would like to be perfect first time, it's not a thing. And it's so interesting. I think because of the way society is just now, that they want to get things done ASAP, and so they don't lose money, they don't lose time. But sometimes you need to be willing to, like you said, explore, find out things, and fail, and go, okay, I failed at this. Right. I know that's a weakness of mine. How do I improve it? Like you said, and I love that idea of going into a project or reflecting on a project and going, right, this next time I need to learn in design, or, oh, this was really good because I did X, Y, and Z. I will take that into my new product. I'm a massive fan of trying to learn something from anything I do. And then if it's something I'm a repeatable thing, like say if it's a stream or something, I go, okay, next stream, I want to make sure that the subtitles work or blah, blah, blah. And then how do I do that? And just spending that little bit of time beforehand just to look at it.
Yeah.
If it works, great. And if I look back at it, it goes, oh, it stopped working or the audio is a little bit off. Oh, that's a shame, but I could do it for next time.
I think RPGs, much like streaming and basically any other creative industry, have this sort of inherent tension where you have people who are pursuing it professionally and doing it as their job, sitting next to hobbyists. And I don't say hobbyists to be disparaging.
Not at all, no.
And often when you try to give advice to people, you get response from people who are hobbyists saying, well, I don't want to do that. Why do I need to do that? And not speaking to those people, I think, is...
No.
If you just want to be a hobbyist and you just want to kind of put out stuff for fun, then just do that. And,
great.
The place to start is wherever you want to start and do whatever you want to do. And there's no pressure for you to succeed or do it well.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you want to do it professionally or at least try it with an eye to doing it professionally, then I think the key is to treat it professionally from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with things like, especially with things like writing, a lot of people look at writing and think, well, I learned to write when I was a kid. I've been reading books since I was a kid. It's easy and I can do that. But it is a craft and it is a skill set. Mm. And it takes active work to get really good at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You'll see, I've seen some people say that the advice to write every day, and again, I'm doing air quotes, is like hustle culture, grind set nonsense, which is really funny because you would never say to a visual artist or an illustrator who says, I draw every day. Oh, you're on your grind set.
That's so wild.
You'd say, no, you're honing your craft. You're working at your art. But
exactly.
I don't know why people have a different response to writing.
That's so weird. Yeah.
It's weird. And the thing with writing every day as well as advice is that it's not about words on the page.
No, of course not.
It's about ritual and it's about routine. And it's about sitting in front of a blank page for an hour and giving yourself space to write, even if no actual words happen.
100%. Yeah, I completely agree. It's just as the same with podcasting as well. Like, I don't think of myself as like amazing podcaster, but because I, again, work have cottoned on that I do podcasting and people go, oh, yes, we just want to create a podcast. And I have to be like, what do you want to do? yeah. It is about like, okay, reviewing the work, all that sort of thing, but realizing that, you know, you putting in a lot to it to get out. And like we were saying before, like this idea that not only are you, you know, recording, hosting, editing your social media, you're doing this to get out there, you need to put in all that effort to it. So you can start a podcast, anyone can start a podcast, but to make it good,
I've started so many podcasts.
Yes, exactly. Thank you so much, Chris. I was just going to sort of sign us up for sort of the penultimate question of like, what can we look forward to, like what's your upcoming projects that you can talk about, anything that we should be keeping an eye out for?
So I have a Kickstarter that's very overdue, a book called Down in Yongerdy, which is a solo game book for Troika that I've been working on for over 2 years at this point. People have been very, thankfully, mostly been very patient with it. It's lurching over the finish line. I'm in like final proof, because obviously with it being a solo game book, like there's so many branching paths and things to proof, and it's very boring and labor intensive, but it's getting there.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be coming out digitally, I hope, within the next couple of weeks. I said that it was going to be out at the beginning of February and then I was sick, but that's lurching over the line. What else? I've just started work on a massive campaign setting for a dungeon game, sort of inspired by Luke Gehring's Wolves Upon the Coast, which, if you don't know Wolves Upon the Coast, it's like one of the best things that's come out in the 50-year history of D&D. It's that good. That's going to be a very long, very slow, deliberately slow, no pressure process for myself. But if you are on my Patreon, you will have seen like several updates about that already. And it's all going to be like all the behind the scenes, show your work, sort of like, here's what draw the rest of the fucking owl actually looks like stuff is going to be on my Patreon. So take a look at that if you're so inclined. There's lots of stuff coming up this year, but I don't know what I can talk about, so
totally understandable. Well, those sound incredibly exciting, and
I'm very excited.
Best of luck for again, deadlines, I know, but you'll get over it, and I appreciate if you've not been well and everything like that, then things get back. So Chris, if we want to find out more about yourself, more about your work, sign up to your newsletter and stuff, where can we do that? Where can we find you on the internet?
Oh God, everywhere. I'm one of those people who stupidly doesn't have uniform usernames across every service. I have a newsletter on Substack, goes out roughly once a month. It's chrisbissett.substack.com. So I announce a lot of stuff there. And I'm also on Patreon, patreon.com/chrisbissett. Well, you can give me money every month to listen to the inside of my head if you've enjoyed listening to the inside of my head for the past hour. It's a lot like this, but in written form. And a dungeon game is free. The most current version is always going to be the web version, and that's at dungeon.lootheroom.uk.
Brilliant. Oh, well, thank you so much, Chris, and you know, best of luck. I'm very looking forward to stuff coming up, certainly for a dungeon game. And yeah, I'm very interested with this Troika book as well. I'm like, oh, because I've only just recently got into Troika myself, and I'm like,
Troika's so good. It's so good.
I'm hoping to do more of these special Q&A bonus episodes in future, including Q&As on the one shots we've run here at What Am I Rolling. If you have a question or think of an RPG designer you'd like to see interviewed on this podcast, just let us know. Our email address is whatamirollingpodcast@gmail.com. And that's it. Great. See you next time.